This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Taking a look at the issues surrounding the health and well-being of our LGBTIQ+ communities. This is Well Well Well, brought to you by the team from Thorn Harbour Health on Joy and the Community Radio Network.
Amelia Arnold is a familiar voice on Joy and has visited us on Well 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 a number of times. We're very happy to have Amelia back. Amelia is a bisexual queer woman whose professional expertise spans research, research translation, and service delivery in the areas of sexual and reproductive health, fertility, mental health, lived experience work, and LGBTIQA+ service experience. Amelia works coordinating the training and capacity building work within the sexual and reproductive health promotion team at Women's Health in the North, that's WIN. And Amelia also works as a research associate with the Growing Queer Families Alliance within the Centre of Research Excellence Health in Preconception and Pregnancy at Monash University. I nearly got through.
There's a long list of accolades there.
Tonight we are discussing a research paper Amelia co-authored with colleagues from the Growing Queer Families Alliance alongside Jess Permazel, Dr. Ruth McNair, Jacob Thomas, Dr. Rhonda Brown and Professor Helen Skouteris. Amelia just got back from Glasgow in Scotland, where she presented this paper at the Sexuality and Social Work Conference. Hello, Amelia.
Hi, Rach. How are you going?
I'm glad I got through that intro, that's for sure.
Oh, my God. Every time you do my intro, I die a little bit. but thanks for having me on. It's always a pleasure joining you folks on Well, Well, Well.
Now, let's... start with earlier this year you were a guest on our show about the upcoming LGBTIQ+ Women's Health Conference, and you mentioned a paper that was about to be published that looked at LGBTIQA+ experiences of preconception and pregnancy care. It's now been published. Can you tell us about that article and what it's meant for you to have this research out there?
Yeah, for sure. So we were really fortunate to have a systematic review which looked at the experiences of LGBTIQA+ communities in preconception, pregnancy and birth, published in the Journal of Midwifery last month, which was very, very exciting. Part of that was also being invited along with the research team that you just mentioned to be guest editors for a special edition looking at LGBTIQA+ experiences for communities who are navigating creating their families or growing their families. So that was a real honour to be able to guest edit that journal and the submissions that were coming through. But our article specifically is a systematic review, which basically means that we looked at the research in the reproductive health space that spoke to the experiences of sex, sexuality and gender diverse people. So what's out there, what research exists, and what is it telling us? The systematic review that we did included 37 articles, and most of that research was conducted in the US and Canada. So 10 articles came from US and 10 from Canada. And primarily looked at the experiences of lesbian, cisgender women, non-heterosexual women or co-mothers was another term that was used within the research. Trans, non-binary people and their partners who were birthing. And also a small number of those studies looked at the experiences of healthcare professionals who were working with LGBTIQA+ communities. So it was great to have that systematic review, not only great to participate in that with my colleague Jess as co-authors and with the rest of the expertise of the research group, be able to get a really comprehensive understanding of what the evidence base for LGBTIQA+ communities who are navigating the mainstream healthcare system in having their families and creating their families and birthing their children, it was great to have a bit more of an understanding of what the evidence base is. So what we then did, Jess and myself travelled over to Glasgow in Scotland just recently to present the findings of that systematic review at the Sexuality and Social Work Conference. And then we also held a workshop with social workers and other conference attendees on what best practice can look like to LGBTIQA plus communities. So summarising those findings from within the systematic review and communicating and sharing with conference attendees what that can look like in practice.
Amelia, I suppose you've spoken to us a little bit about what was involved in the process of doing that systematic review. Mm-hmm. I guess, why is it important? Why is it crucial in carrying out further research and work in this area?
So one of the reasons that we approached a systematic review was that we wanted to know what the current evidence base was, and we did find that there was limited research in this area in Australia. And as Australian queer researchers, that was really useful information to have, because it then provides confirmation that more research is needed to be done in this space. So when you're scoping, when you're considering doing research in a particular area, a literature review or a systematic review is integral to understand what's already out there. And so from that process of doing the systematic review, what became very clear to us was that more research definitely needs to be done within Australia that speaks to the local experiences of sex, sexuality and gender diverse people in having their families, building their families, what family formation looks like for LGBTIQA plus communities here, what experiences of the mainstream healthcare system and the sister reproductive treatment system looks like. So it was very helpful for us to understand that and what directions future research, it informed what directions future research could go in.
Amelia, some people, I imagine many people, probably wouldn't even be familiar with the term preconception. Can you tell us what is involved in preconception and what do we need to consider before pregnancy?
Huge question. Preconception is basically any time before you conceive a child or a pregnancy, or someone conceives a child or a pregnancy. If you are wanting to grow your family, if you know that you want to have children and you're able to carry a pregnancy, then to me, preconception is quite a period of time, because what we know in some queer relationships is that we might need some help in growing our families or building our families or beginning our families. So when we might need some additional help in that space, there's a lot of thinking that might need to go into that. So if you need to use a donor, for example, so someone who is providing you with donor sperm or donor eggs, that's something that needs to be considered well in advance. If you're planning on going through a clinic instead and still wanting to use donor sperm or donor eggs, then financially that's something to prepare for. If you're wanting to conceive at home with the support of a partner or partners and maybe plus or minus donors, figuring out how you want to grow your family, from my perspective, is very important in the queer experience of preconception, because in some relationships, some queer relationships, they are able to conceive at home with a partner. For some people, that's not the case. And so it requires more thinking, more planning, potentially financial planning, logistics planning. What do I want my family to look like and how can I achieve that? So when I talk about preconception, it can mean all of those things, as well as what do I need to put into place before I grow my family? Are there health things that I need to consider or address? What conversations might I want to or need to have with people who are going to be within my family. What's my family going to look like? So when I talk about preconception, it includes all of those things. And for some folks who are then having to interface with the healthcare system, either mainstream or otherwise, making some plans for what that might look like as well.
You alluded to, I suppose, some of those LGBTIQA plus experiences around preconception or when people are considering pregnancy. I suppose, mm-hmm. what are some of the LGBTIQA plus experiences that you had uncovered or realized exist to a greater extent through this literature review beyond preconception?
Cool. So as in, what are some of the themes that we identified through the systematic review
yes.
as experiences? Yeah. So the main themes that we identified through the systematic review of the evidence base for LGBTIQA plus folks who were in the preconception, pregnancy or postpartum period, themes that emerged was the unavailability of information, services and support for LGBTIQA plus folks that mainly spoke to the experiences of sexuality and gender diverse experiences. So absence of information that was inclusive of our communities and our experiences, the reliance on self-research or having to speak to people that you know who have navigated a fertility clinic, for example, or a donor program, for example, the burden being on self information gathering, and which can then delay your own treatment. It can put delays on the creation of your family because you're having the way forward yourself. And that information not necessarily being readily available. Another, under that theme of unavailability of information, we also heard that some services or supports or care or treatment, whatever word feels best, felt inaccessible to some LGBTIQA plus folks. We know that specifically in reproductive health care and sexual spaces with a cis normative expectation. So any folks who don't fit within that cis normative expectation then have difficulty in navigating what is very gendered healthcare provision. So continually interfacing with systems like Medicare, where you may have a different legal name recorded on your Medicare card, for example. The demographic information that's provided within the healthcare service that you're accessing might be non-trans inclusive, for example. A lack of then staff or education to help people navigate that process. So that was the first theme, was unavailability of information, services and support. The second theme that came out of the systematic review was interpersonal competencies of healthcare staff. So individual literacy or familiarity of healthcare service providers with LGBTIQA plus specific experiences. So having poor communication between service users and people in service delivery roles, a lack of being involved in decision making. So by virtue of having to go through the healthcare system, which, you know, for some LGBTIQA plus folks, we don't actually need intervention in a medical sense. There isn't necessarily infertility or a pathology. It's just we need some extra help. We need some extra ingredients. Some of us just need sperm. Some of us just need eggs. That process can be medicalized when it doesn't necessarily need to be. And so decision making around what creating a family could look like is taken out of your hands. For some folks, that was also, they also reported a lack of affirming experiences. So not having their trans identity affirmed, not having their sexuality identity affirmed, in a mainstream healthcare space, and a lack of literacy or training that is specific to the experiences of sexuality, sex and gender diverse folks in health, reproductive healthcare. That was the second theme. We had two more, the third being heterosexist or cissexist expectations of how people interface with the healthcare system. So similar to the previous theme, heterosexual assumptions or cis-sexist assumptions about what your family looks like, what names you use to describe people in your, how you want to have a, achieve a pregnancy, how, who is going to carry a pregnancy, etc. And then finally, discrimination and traumatization was the final theme that that came out of the existing evidence base. So where people were refused treatment based upon their sexuality, sex or gender, people experienced discrimination because of their identity or their and poor episodes of care that people received, which led to increased dysphoria or a diminished sense of self or potentially birth trauma. They were the main themes that, that came out of the existing evidence base, which is useful to know. This is how some LGBTIQA plus folks are interfacing with the mainstream healthcare system, because then we, with that knowledge, we can then advocate for changes and do further research in a local setting as well.
What could people do when they face that inequity and discrimination? Is there somewhere they can contact or strategies they can use to advocate for their rights to safe healthcare?
Oh, that's such a great question, Jack. And I wish there was a place where people could go so that the burden isn't always on self-advocacy. I think that different healthcare settings is the burden of advocacy is on the individual when they do experience care that is not affirming or is dangerous or harmful. The burden is then to tell someone about it, to complain, to make noise. And we also know that when you have experienced poor care or you have experienced addict using, has to happen before you're able to potentially advocate for yourself, right? So it's really difficult because there are folks who want to see something change for other LGBTIQA plus individuals for the benefit of our communities down the track. But the way to make that happen is you have to complain and you have to relive that experience and you have to go into it in detail. So it's a really tricky thing. And I think I personally, as a researcher, am so grateful when people do share their stories in these kinds of settings, because then we do have evidence that people who are in policy or advocacy roles can then draw upon and feed back to people who are in decision-making positions around how our reproductive health and assisted reproductive treatment and birth spaces do look and what is needed from workers in that space. So I wish there was a specifically place where people could go. One avenue potentially is speaking with BARTA. If you're in NAM or in so-called Victoria, which is the Victorian Assisted Reproductive Treatment Authority, they're an organisation that does oversee a lot of work in the assisted reproductive treatment space, and would be an organisation potentially to contact. Alternatively, at the moment, there is also a birth injury or birth trauma inquiry that's going on that's been organised through the New South Wales state government, which is open to submissions from people across so-called Australia. So that is closing next week, I believe. So if people are wanting to potentially contribute their experiences there, that could be another avenue. And I guess in lieu of being able to complain directly, or if people have had experiences that are less than ideal or discriminatory or harmful at work, we encourage people to share those experiences if they're able to, when there are call outs for our research in this space, so that we can draw upon the stories of our communities and utilize them to advocate for changes within our healthcare system. We saw that happen a few years ago. There was the independent review into assisted reproductive treatments in Victoria and around so-called Australia, which ended in 2019. We had a report that was called the Gorton Review. And one of the findings of that review was that all assisted reproductive treatment providers within Victoria were expected to undertake capacity building or training specific to the experiences of LGBTIQA plus communities. So that was great. And that outcome wouldn't have happened if our communities weren't so willing to share their experiences of navigating a mainstream healthcare experience or clinic, and sharing what that was like and advocating for better experiences for future patients, service users, individuals who are growing their families. So that's something that people can do. Outside of those more formal kind of strategies or options, connecting with other LGBTIQA plus families can be really healing and can be really helpful for people who are at the start of their journey. So hearing from people who have navigated the same experiences that are in front of you, or that importance of shared experience, shared connection, other people who have a family that looks like yours, other people who are moving towards having a family that looks like yours. What we heard overwhelmingly in the systematic review was that connecting with other LGBTIQA plus parents or people who were planning for parenthood was so helpful in the sharing of resources, in the sharing of experiences that are relevant to our communities. It was really nourishing. It was really healing. Connecting with people who understand what your family looks like. And so that could be another opportunity for folks, either at the start of their journey towards rainbow family formation, or who already have a rainbow family and are looking to connect with other people. We do also have Rainbow Families Victoria, which are currently operating out of Switchboard Victoria, which is fantastic. So shout out to those folks who are throwing some great events for rainbow families over the coming months. And there are also, through people's local councils, there's the option to connect in with other rainbow family play groups, or see if there are other, I guess, peer-based support groups or networks out there for to connect with and meet other people that have family like yours.
Emily, let's talk a little bit about the conference that you attended in Glasgow, the Sexuality and Social Work Conference, where you presented this paper. Can you tell us a little bit about how some of your favourite memories or takeaways from that conference, and any other presentations or findings that have actually stuck with you?
It was really fantastic to be within a conference that was centering the experience of sexuality, diversity and gender diversity within social work. So I was really grateful for that, especially because it was an international conference. And Jess and myself went over and presented the findings of our systematic review, but also facilitated a workshop around what can LGBTIQA plus affirming practice look like in a mainstream setting, just for participants who might be there and who might be interested to learn that information. But for me, it was really also humbling to hear from researchers and workers from other countries where the laws and protections that are in place for LGBTIQA plus communities are nowhere near what we have in Australia. And, you know, it was very humbling hearing some researchers coming along and sharing that within their country that they're working in, it criminalized still to be LGBTIQA plus. that people can't share their sexuality or gender when they're navigating creating a family, that only one parent is able to be put on the birth certificate, for example, that people can't share or attend school if they're in a same-sex or queer relationship for fear of their child being harmed or bullied. So it was humbling to hear stories of what parenting can look like in other countries around the globe. And it was also really inspiring to hear the other areas of practice that people are engaging with in relation to sexuality, sex and gender. For me, my favourite presentation was a keynote that was delivered by an incredible professor in the US whose work intersects with sexuality and also social work, health promotion, sexuality education, sex education, who practices from a kink affirming perspective and from a sex work affirming perspective, and areas that, you know, 5-10 years ago, even now in some practices of social work, could be viewed, you know, from a really conservative lens. And so it was really inspiring to hear how people integrate so many different aspects of their queer lived experience into the research work that they're doing. Plus, it was just nice to have a conference that focuses on shared queer experience and how we use that in our work, but also how we do the work when we're working with other queers as well. So I was really fortunate to be able to attend that and share what we had done, but also learn from others. And I think that's a beautiful part of a conference.
I guess off the back of the sexuality and social work conference, what's next? Are there more publications on the way or other key activities happening related to this work?
So the Research Alliance is, now that we have this systematic review and it's informed that there does need to be more work in this space, that is the plan. We are looking to do some more research into what the state of LGBTIQA plus experiences in Australia of reproductive healthcare and sexual healthcare is. We're also endeavouring to do a project in the next few months that centres rainbow families and the strengths that rainbow families have, and what rainbow families can look like. So we saw within the marriage equality campaign and a lot of other campaigns for equality on this continent, we've seen, you know, some portrayals of rainbow families, but we're really interested to show from a strength-based perspective the diversity that our families can have, what our families can look like. Is there one parent? Are there two parents? Are there three parents? Are there donors? Are there surrogates? Are there many members of chosen family who are involved in bringing up children? What can our families look like? And what is the strength and power that we have within our families? And what can non-LGBTIQA plus communities learn from our families? I feel like a lot of research can focus on the non-strengths. So what are some difficulties that we come up against? What are some barriers? But we have so much strength and resilience within our families that it's important to be able to share that with the world as well, especially in a political climate where our events are being challenged or cancelled or seen as extreme, when in actual fact we know that these events are nourishing and connecting for communities, and also just generally story time. So we think it's really important to continue to understand what the experiences of LGBTIQA plus people are in mainstream healthcare, but also demonstrate the incredible resilience and strength within our communities and share those stories more broadly as well.
Amelia Arnold, Research Associate from the Growing Queer Families Alliance within the Centre of Research Excellence, Health and Preconception and Pregnancy at Monash University. It's a long title. Thank you so much for joining us this week on Well, Well, Well.
No worries. Thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure speaking with you folks.
Thanks for listening to Well, 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 supported by Thorn Harbour Health on Joy and the Community Radio Network. For more LGBTIQ plus health and wellbeing and much more, check out Thorn Harbour on social media at Thorn Harbour or via the website thornharbour.org.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.